I'm Lawrence Douglas from the Department of Law, Jurisprudence, and Social Thought, and with me here today is Cullen Murphy. Cullen graduated Amherst in the class of 1974. He was for many years editor of the Atlantic Monthly. He is now contributing editor at Vanity Fair. He's the author of several books, most recently Are We Rome, which will be the subject of our discussion today. Cullen Murphy, thanks so much for talking with us today.
Thanks very much, Lawrence, for having me here.
How did you come to write this book?
I began noticing, just listening to people around me speaking, you hear phrases rolling out, like the president referred to as, you know, the imperial president, or sporting events referred to with the players as gladiators, or American forces being referred to as legions. So the notion that there's some kind of comparison in the popular mind between modern America and ancient Rome is clearly out there in the culture somehow. So that's a kind of background sentiment behind the book. But beyond that, there's what happened after the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989. When finally the whole superpower structure falls apart, the United States emerges as the sole superpower, the hyperpower, as the French began to call us. And really, for the first time, the United States emerges on the scene as the power, with power that's really unrivaled globally since Rome in its part of the world. And you begin to hear conservative commentators actually making this comparison very explicitly. The Pax Americana, they talk about as a parallel to the Pax Romana. So these were some of the things that began to percolate. But it wasn't simply an empire notion that was in my mind. It was as much a social comparison, what's going on inside this vast entity and that one. So that's really what lay behind the initial inquiry.
Did you also think of it as not simply a, say, post-fall of Berlin Wall book, but also a post-9/11 book, and in response to the Bush administration?
I'll have to concede that the Bush administration was certainly never far from my mind. People often ask me, if there was a Roman emperor, which one would Bush be? And they're generally the ones who are first to offer, you know, would it be Caligula? And I don't want to go there.
Right.
Mostly it's not a post 9/11 book. Mostly this book is about issues that actually predate the Bush administration. They're far more fundamental than anything that has happened during the past 7 or 8 years. Not that they haven't been exacerbated or accelerated during the past 7, 8 years, but when you look at things like American military power in the world and how overstretched we are, this was a debate we've been having for decades.
Sure.
When you look at things like immigration, you know, again, a long debate, privatization of government services, the idea of manifest destiny. None of these things were tied to a particular administration. So it's not really a post-9/11 book or a post-Iraq war book.
Right. One thing I liked very much in the book was how you tie your history to your own experience of travels. You mentioned that you had first gone to Rome, I think, at the age of 12. You talk about the experience of walking along Hadrian's Wall. And I was also intrigued about how that style of bringing your own personal experience into your writing also agreed in a way with some of the things that you're saying in the book itself about our need to know the world. How vital do you think it is to kind of get out of the United States to see the world, to be a citizen of it today?
Well, I think it's absolutely essential. It's one of the things that, since we're talking about our location right now is Amherst College, it's one of the things that I like to see about Amherst students, how frequently they travel abroad. Although when I think of my own experience, I'm acutely and painfully aware of how Eurocentric it is. And I hope that becomes less and less so as time goes on. you know, as a piece of writing, I was always wondering how much of my own experience to bring into a book like this. You know, part of you wants to keep it to the side and simply say, you know, is that legitimate? Why does what I went through matter? And at the same time, I just couldn't help but recall these powerful, you know, resonant moments in my own life that seemed to be somehow germane. Have you been to Rome? You probably have.
I was in Rome 2 years ago. We rented an apartment there in the summer 2 years ago, and it was the first time I had been back since I was a child. I was there when I was 9 years old and didn't have particularly strong memories, and I ended up liking the city much, much more than I had anticipated liking it.
Did you have the sense, as I did, if not on that first visit, but on this second one? Now, here you have a place that was once the center of the world, and it's now, you know, a pretty marvelous city. But for me, it's hard to escape this notion of change, just compressed into this rather compact city. So much has happened, and you can't turn a corner without wondering, you know, why is this there? Why is that a ruin? What happened in the last 2,000 years? At least that's the way my own mind gets animated when I'm in that city, which really then begins to point you to your own society. You know, what is it going to look like in 500 years or 1,000 years?
I had somewhat of a similar feeling when I was in Jerusalem. One thing about Rome is really how small it is. It's very easy to kind of walk across its entire length. Israeli writer Amos Ilon was talking about the air over Jerusalem being polluted with history, and kind of had a similar feeling in Rome of there was just, it's so dense with history, there's so many different layers of history that's confronting you at any given moment. I also felt kind of ignorant about it. Now, you seem to know the history quite intimately. You know the language, obviously you know Latin. Do you know Italian as well?
No.
No. And did you study classics at Amherst?
No, I didn't. I had the great good fortune of having a part of my earlier education take place in Ireland. And everything, because there isn't this expectation that people are going to be going on to college, a lot of education is foreshortened, mm-hmm. in a way, and you begin studying things like Latin when you're in sixth grade. So I had that advantage. One of the things about Rome that has always appealed to me, and I think is a real prod to thinking, is the fact that you actually can look back on it in a way that you can't look back on your own society yet. And it's palpable that something large and transformational occurred here. And I think we know in our heads that something large and transformational is actually occurring in front of our eyes. I mean, how can it not be? And yet we can't see it, and our grandchildren probably won't see it. But you can't help but wonder what it is. And it's for that reason that I wanted to try to use the Roman example as a kind of an aid to my own thinking. Certainly not as any kind of, you know, simplistic comparison, you know, or deterministic set of parallels, which is not what I'm doing.
Yeah, I mean, one thing I enjoyed tremendously about the book was you certainly create certain parallels between the United States and Rome. You also make very clear differences between it, and you even raise this whole question about, to the extent one tends to think about Rome as the cautionary tale. You raise the question of whether Rome even really fell.
It is a wonderful question to think about, and I do find that when you bring this up with people who haven't, you know, necessarily read a lot about Rome, that the idea that historians raise that as a question, whether playfully or literally, often comes as a surprise. You know, there's a wonderful historian, Peter Brown, historian of late antiquity, who very eloquently makes this case. You know, he talks about how if you're actually looking on the ground at evidence in the period of late antiquity, in the early medieval era, you find so much more continuity than the popular image of the fall of Rome would lead you to believe. And look at our own society. You know, in the last 200 years, the extraordinary amount of transformation that has occurred in the United States. You know, we were once an agrarian society. You know, now we're on the edge of being a genetic and something else society. In terms of our demographics, we don't look anything like what we looked like in 1776. Our political institutions, they may be the same in many respects because of the Constitution, and yet suffrage is something that's very different. Civil rights is very different. And yet we've endured somehow as a society with recognizable elements from over this period of time. And yet if you dropped, Thomas Jefferson, if you just took him out of Monticello and dropped him into our own society, he might very well think that America fell somewhere between that period.
Right. It made me actually wonder, so what if America falls? I mean, do you think it would be a bad thing if America falls? I mean, let's put it this way. I mean, you make it very clear that Rome did not fall in the manner that Berlin did. And so there are massive, horrific collapses, and then there are somewhat more gentle declines. And if you go into England today, I mean, you can say England has fallen. I lived in London a few years ago, and one of the things I actually kind of liked about living in London was the absence of this kind of American hegemonic discourse that one hears on the television or in the news. And so I was just wondering, would it be a bad thing in your mind for America to fall?
Well, you know how often people take one word and then try to insert a different word in its place. You know, we try not to talk about problems. We talk about challenges. And so my temptation is to take out the word fall and put in the word transformation. Surely it's inevitable. One of the points I try to make at the end is the truly foolish thing would be for us to try to freeze the status quo in terms of our social structure, the way our domestic political arrangements are organized, our power in the world. It just can't be. It can't be frozen, and that it would make more sense to try to focus on underlying enduring things like an educated populace, for instance, and that by doing so, in fact, you are giving whatever society you're living in, whatever its name is, more healthy longevity than you would be otherwise.
Right. Two questions about that. First, going back to the point that you made about plopping Thomas Jefferson into America today and the feeling that, he might look at it and say we are in decline or we have fallen. You make a point that the founders certainly were dedicated to principles of civic engagement, civic republicanism that you find perhaps sadly wanting in many politicians today. On the other hand, you do find, going back to the founding, documents such as Madison's Federalist Number 10, which seems to say, would it be nice to have leaders who are dedicated to civic republicanism? Sure, it would be nice. Is it really necessary for the health of a country? Not really. Let people kind of pursue their own rational self-interest, and the good will come from that. So in a way, isn't there kind of a very sort of long tradition that even goes all the way back to the founders of the type of politics of, let's say, privatization, of simply pursuing rational self-interest, that in a kind of way you bemoan the prevalence of today?
Well, you may be right. There was an editor of mine when I was at the Atlantic Monthly who was very influential as far as my own writing and thinking. And one of the things I remember him doing is whenever I would write the phrase, typical American, he would cross out the word typical, saying there is not and never has been and never will be a typical American. And so in some sense, I think, broad and sweeping generalizations are always going to be a little bit suspect. What I was worried about in the book, which you articulated partly, was on the one hand, a kind of loss of a notion of Roman civic virtue on the part of the elites. I do believe that to be the case. Not that there was much of it during the Gilded Age either. You know, things have their cycles. And at the same time, I'm also talking about an evolution in the way in which we conceive the proper role of government. And for a considerable period of time, at least for a century, the notion that government has a more active role to play has been in the ascendant. And I would argue largely successfully. And my worry is that we're in the process of some sort of it's not turning on a dime, but the ship is definitely beginning to come around on that. And I think that's a very worrisome development.
In terms of trying to promote civic virtue and civic dedication, one of the things that you propose towards the end of the book is to have a program of national service. And I think about that both in terms of a prescription for the nation at large and also as a recommendation for, let's say, at Amherst College. How do you imagine that? Would you imagine, for example, military service as being a required element of that? You talk about coming from a quite well-to-do family in Greenwich, Connecticut, and yet nonetheless, two of your siblings, I think you mentioned, were in the military. Do you think is military service as kind of a necessary component of some kind of program of national service?
I don't personally, and I think politically it's a non-starter. However, I think national service of some sort, where there's an expectation that you do something, I think is more than not a non-starter. I think it may be on the verge of being an inevitability. I think for different reasons, on both the left and right, there has begun to be a kind of coalescence around this idea. I would actually be surprised if there was not some sort of incipient national service program in place within the next decade. It might not be total in the way that Social Security was not total in its origins, but I think it would be the germ of something that actually would grow. And, you know, military service could be part of it, of course, but so could whatever the equivalence of VISTA or Teach for America or CITIER or, you know, who knows what would be involved. And I certainly hope that's the case. And you brought up Amherst College. I'm very glad to see the start of the Center for Community Engagement. I think that kind of notion of service is actually embodied in the very founding of the college. It was de-emphasized in during the years when I was here in some ways, although there was a lot of activism, there wasn't that kind of activism. I think it's a very important part of what the education here ought to be about.
I also want to maybe connect two other recommendations in your book to maybe the education here at Amherst. One has to do with the notion of strengthening institutions of assimilation, educational institutions, for example. One thing that I thought was fascinating in the book is the way you described the borders of Rome as being really quite porous and intentionally permeable. That is, you describe, and it's certainly the experience that I've had of looking at a history book and looking at the outer perimeters of the Roman Empire and thinking that's where the concertina wire was, and that's when no one crossed back and forth over those thresholds. And in fact, you point out that the frontier was intentionally quite permeable. And you talk about the need to strengthen institutions that can play a role about bringing outsiders into our country. And again, I wonder what you imagine the role of a place like Amherst College would be in furthering that end.
Well, let me come back to Amherst in 1 second, mm-hmm. but just on the notion of borders. Yeah, of course, in some places the borders were pretty firm and had to be. There were enemies out there. But in other places, as you say, the borders of Rome were very porous, as ours are porous. And they were porous for the same reason, because of the need for trade and the need for people. And one of the reasons that porous borders, in a way, work is when the society that's being penetrated is so powerful in terms of its culture, that the people coming in, you know, it's like pouring currants into a cake, you know, while you're stirring. The culture is so powerful that the outsiders just can't help. I mean, they're attracted by what they see, and once inside, you know, they begin to become part of it, even as they change it. And it's a wonderfully dynamic process, and you see it happening in Rome to an extraordinary extent, where, you know, people who will come in, they're called the new men. You know, they're treated with a little bit of suspicion. Oh, you know where his father came from, and so on. And then within a generation, you know, these people are consuls, and then at some point they're emperors. And the social mobility was quite something to behold. In terms of a successful multi-ethnic society, you know, Rome was not dissimilar to we ourselves in many ways. Now, with respect to Amherst, one of the great things that has occurred during the past couple of decades, and particularly within the last decade and a half, I'd say, is the way the college has come more to reflect the nature of our society as a whole, and to some extent more the nature of the world. I think for an institution that has the ambition of producing the sorts of people who are going to be the leaders in whatever their fields happen to be, you know, whether it's, you know, business or the professions or academia and so on, that kind of background is absolutely essential. Otherwise, you'll be producing people who have experience of just some narrow slice of a particular demographic, and that's not particularly helpful. It's not particularly healthy.
Right. And in terms of the kind of inwardness that you describe both Rome suffering from and the United States suffering from, one of the prescriptions that you make is you believe that people should learn foreign languages, which seems eminently reasonable and right to me. I guess with respect to Amherst, do you think that should be a requirement? That is, do you think Amherst should require that students study a foreign language? And I guess on the level of recommendation, we have two boys, and our older boy a couple years ago had to make a choice as to which language in school to study. And it came down to a choice between Chinese and Latin. And I said, Chinese. And he stubbornly insisted on Latin. And so I guess I was wondering, so there are two kind of questions there. One is, require language teaching at Amherst, and what would you recommend, Latin or Arabic or Chinese?
Well, I have a son at the University of Chicago who is taking Arabic.
So your son listens to you at least.
Oh, I didn't. I didn't recommend. My own story was, this is a little bit odd, but back when I was applying to Amherst, you had the choice. There was a language requirement back then, as there isn't now. And you could opt out of the language requirement if you took an AP test and got above a certain level, and you were then deemed proficient in that language, and you didn't have to take any further language. And I took my AP test in Latin. And so I was deemed to be language proficient. Now, as you can imagine, that knowledge of Latin has taken me around the world where everybody understands me now.
Right.
And in the Amherst context, first of all, lots of people are coming here who already know a second language. Some, increasingly, people are coming here who are bilingual because of the circumstances in which they grew up. So it isn't always necessary to have a requirement, but I do think having a second language is to be strongly encouraged, and that it should be pointed out that in the world in which that we are entering, if you don't have a second language, you are in a sense illiterate. Just as you're illiterate in a sense if you don't know economics in the modern world, you have to be able to negotiate a culture other than your own somehow or you're going to be confined to some little eddy of our civilization. I think that point is being made increasingly at Amherst. Do you?
I think that we should require. I'm a bit of a kind of old school when it comes to these things. I think I had my own experiences as an undergraduate. I was at Brown. I went to law school at Yale. Both of those schools are kind of known as having Amherst-like curricula, basically have no curriculum whatsoever. And I guess I've sort of come to the conclusion that a little bit of requirements isn't necessarily a bad thing. And that because of the benefits, as you point out, of learning a second language are so clear, whereas and it also just strikes me as one of those kind of things that because it's not necessarily the easiest process learning a second language, it is the kind of thing that you might want to create special motivations for, as in require it. And I do think that the benefits are very, very high. So I guess my personal feeling would, I'd like to see a language requirement placed into the Amherst curriculum.